brought to my attention last time that my decibel level was somewhere in the range of physical pain, certainly above the legal limits for noise pollution. So this is going to be light and airy as a madrigal. Okay. We'll be referring only briefly to this sheet tonight, although you may need it for one or two items. And you should have gotten a small handout from the door, the quality of which I apologize for. I'm going to begin, actually, with neither age nor sex. I'm going to start with stature. We mentioned stature the last time as one of the parameters of a skeletal population which you can recover. And I gave you a few examples, but I didn't have the information to give you on each bone. And tonight I've brought some slides of most of the major long bones to show you, so that I can show you exactly which measurement to take, so that on the sheet that you have there where it says maximum length of femur, tibia, fibula, humerus, ulna, and radius, you'll have something to show for that. And in fact, we'll start off with that. That's the first thing we'll do. Now, stature is related to nutrition. It's related to morbidity, that is, the number of diseases a person has, especially during their formative years. During their growing periods, if you happen to contract a disease, even if it's not a particularly serious one, nevertheless, that disease has some possibility of taking a toll on your overall stature as an adult. So, in other words, stature is very variable, even within a population, as we could tell, as I said before, by having everyone in the room stand up. Those of us who are from the same population would find that we have a great deal of variation just among ourselves. Some elements of stature, of course, are genetic. Certain populations tend to be taller than others. The best examples of those being the ones that we mentioned at the end of the last lecture when we described the difference between the Nilotic population, you might say, and Eskimos for reasons of environmental adaptation. Well, one of the people who was here last week asked me for some specific information on stature for some ancient populations. And I didn't have the statistics on the top of my head. I did go home and look some of them up, however. If anyone is interested, the average stature, and this is taken by averaging the males and the females together, so you must expect that males would be somewhat taller and females somewhat shorter than this, in the modern United States samples is 174 centimeters. The Roman, that is urban Rome, in the 3rd century AD, had an average of about 169 centimeters. The Bronze Age here in the Near East is 166 centimeters. The Neolithic, I have three different figures for the Neolithic, one from Neolithic Portugal, from some skeletons I'm studying there, which average out at 161, which is surprisingly tall. However, at Ain Ghazal, which is Gary Rollison's dig here in Amman, we have only between 155 and 158. centimeters, although that was a very small sample, and that may be, in fact, too low. We may discover that as we get more skeletons, the average will rise. And in Neolithic Greece, it's actually quite tall, 167 centimeters. Now, that is almost certainly the result of differences in environment. I mentioned to you that at the end of the Epipaleolithic period, in the beginning of the Neolithic period, one of the things we think happened, although we can't demonstrate it yet because we don't have the samples, but the initial evidence suggests that overall health became considerably worse. Dental health almost certainly took a very steep decline, and stature went along with it. In other words, a food-producing economy such as the Neolithic had was capable of supporting a much larger population, but it supported them at a generally lower health level. Okay, now, when we're taking these stature increment measurements, you might ask what good they are, because we really don't know how tall these people were. We don't know, for example, the tables that someone asked me about the last time. You have a table in this book called Essentials of Forensic Anthropology, and that table gives you a means of estimating the stature of a person just by looking at one of their long bones and taking the maximum length measurement. And you might well ask how it is that we know that that is accurate for ancient populations, and the answer is, we don't know. We don't know that at all. What we must do is get some more intact skeletons excavated in situ and make measurements of the complete length of the body. On your chart here, you will see a slot which I did not mention in the last lecture called sitting height. Now, sitting height is something that you measure by measuring from the top of the skull to the tip of the sacrum. And it shows you how tall this person was when they're sitting down. And then you can actually go all the way along the skeleton if they are articulated and have not been disturbed by water action or rodent action and get a very close estimate of the overall stature of that person. Even if they are disarticulated, if you can get the bones of that one individual all together and measure them, you can estimate the amount of cartilage. It tends to be 2 millimeters on any long bone joint, and get a very close estimate of their living stature. And if we get enough of these, then we will be able to compile a table for ancient populations. In the meantime, most of our estimates from scattered long bones are based upon modern population tables. But as I said, I think the last time, that is not necessarily incorrect. It's just a little bit sloppy. We wish that we could do better immediately, but we won't be able to until we've done a lot more excavation. The ratio of arm length to leg length to body height, we believe, although this is an act of faith, has been relatively, well, much the same all throughout that tiny slot of time that constitutes human history. For prehistory, I'm not sure we can say. Well, okay. What I'd like to do now is show a couple of slides, and we'll look at these bones and describe the measurements that we would like you to take in situ. I think we can leave the lights on so people can see there. Everyone can see that, I'm sure. Now, this is the chart that you should keep handy and refer to from time to time, because it's this chart that's going to show you where on the body these bones belong, although I will identify them individually as we go along. Incidentally, before we begin, I might mention that the lower limb bones in modern populations tend to be slightly more indicative of stature than the upper limb bones. And so when you take the scattered individual bones and measure their maximum length and figure out what the stature of that individual would have been from each of those bones, you normally average the results and then weight your average in favor of the lower limb bones, which tend to be somewhat more accurate. I'm shopping again.
Can I help?
Okay. This is a femur. This is the thigh bone. I'm holding a left in my hand. As you can see here, the maximum length is not actually shown, unfortunately, on this diagram. What you see here is the bicondylar length, or what you might call the oblique length, or some people call it the auricular length, which means that you take the bone, you sit it on a flat surface, and you measure the distance from here to here vertically. That is, the bone is on an angle, but you're measuring vertically. That's not what we want for maximum length, however. For maximum length, we want a measurement between here and here at the bottom. So that's what you take with your tape measure, and you take it to the nearest millimeter, if you can. It's always a surprise to see what comes next. Okay, this is a tibia and a fibula together. These are the bones of the lower leg. That is the shin bone, you might say. Now, in the tibia, this illustration is actually incorrect. This doesn't make a bad pointer, does it? This illustration is incorrect. This small process on top here should not be included in the measurement. When you take your measurement in the field, when you've uncovered this bone, measure from, the lateral condyle right here, all the way down to the tip of what is called the medial malleolus here. That is what we will use for a maximum length measurement for estimation of stature. Do not include those two processes on the top. In the case of the fibula, which is what I'm holding in my hand here, that bone is much easier to do. You just go from one end to the other. That's about all the information the fibula offers as well, except for pathology. It's quite commonly pathological because it's an exposed position in the body. The humerus, I do have a humerus. No, I don't have a humerus. Okay. At any rate, this is a humerus. This is the upper arm bone. And the maximum length, as you can see, is quite clearly delineated here. That's exactly how you should take it, all the way to the tip of the trochlea at the bottom, from the top of what's called the head. And the other measurement which I asked you to take on this bone when you encounter it in the soil, if you can, is the vertical head diameter. The only reason I ask you this, now I'll be measuring it again in the laboratory after you bring the bones back, but this is very delicate, very often broken. and the spongy or cancellous bone underneath here is so fragile in ancient specimens that as often as not, I can't make the measurement later on. The only opportunity we'll have to get the information is when you do it in the field. This has nothing to do with stature, but I wanted to remind you of it again because it's quite indicative of sex. And that the measurement is taken in exactly that plane, from that point to that point. As you will notice, it's not vertical, it's actually diagonal, but it's called the vertical head diameter for reasons which are beyond me. All right, now this is the ulna. The ulna is one of the forearm bones. It's actually the levering bone of the forearm bone which hooks and hinges into the elbow and provides the lifting power of the forearm. The radius is much more gracile, delicate. Now the ulna, again, the maximum length. Take it from top to bottom and include this small process here. When you take the physiological length, which I don't normally ask people to do in the field because I can do it in the laboratory, and sometimes it's a little bit difficult, especially if they don't have a spreading caliper. But nevertheless, if you can take it from this tip here, and that lunate surface, all the way down to the bottom, excluding the small process. Am I sliding these by too quickly? For those of you who might be right, if anybody's interested in excavating skeletons, probably ought to write it down. Okay. Yeah. All right, now what I wanted to talk about tonight was not so much stature, although I did want to remind you of some of those measurements. There was one other thing before I go on. I woke up, you know how you sometimes your eyes fly open in the middle of the night, you're staring at the ceiling, and I said to myself, aloud, I think, I forgot to tell them about the spoons. When I mentioned to you the toolkit, the basic toolkit for excavating skeletons, I completely forgot to mention taking along a set of spoons, just ordinary kitchen spoons, one the largest you can find, almost an e-tool, and one of larger than tablespoon size, and one of tablespoon to teaspoon size. Those are, in fact, some of the most useful implements for excavating skeletons that you will have, because they don't have that sharp cutting surface that will destroy bone when you insert it into the soil. You can lift out a fairly sizable scoop of the loose and friable soil that you normally find in burials, and also it's easy enough to manipulate. I guess you might not want to use it in the kitchen after that if you use it on a burial, but it doesn't bother me, it doesn't bother you. All right. Tonight we're going to talk about age and sex, and actually that's in reverse order. The first thing as you are excavating a skeleton that you should attempt to discern, certainly when you're examining it in the laboratory, is the sex. The reason for this is that age differences are distributed across genders. In other words, females have a tendency to mature earlier, but they stop sooner. Males have a tendency to get a later start, but then they continue on for as much as a year and a half longer. The result of that being, of course, what we call sexual dimorphism, meaning that males are on the average larger and more robust than females. And that is really what we're measuring when we try to determine the sex of a skeleton from a dried bone specimen. Now there are two real categories of sexual dimorphism. One of them you would call metric, or you could say that it's related to degree of growth, as I just outlined. The second one is related to function, and this is only found in the pelvis. The differences between males and females, in a functional sense, are only located in the pelvis, because that's where childbirth primarily takes place, and that's where the skeleton must adapt to childbirth. So we find that there are special adaptations in the female skeleton that we don't find in the male. But most of the field calls that you will make are going to be of what they call a non-metric or subjective nature. You will be looking at the bones in the soil and looking for certain non-metric traits. I don't know why they decided that when you make a metric measurement, and you put it into some sort of a function, and you get the result out the other end, and it has a number attached to it somehow, that's necessarily more objective than looking at some of these non-metric traits and making a decision about sex, because it seems to me that both of them ultimately are based upon subjective ideas of what constitutes gender in the skeleton. Nevertheless, they are, in some cases, highly accurate, surprisingly accurate, And the calls that you will make in the field, if you train your eye to this, will very seldom be contradicted in the laboratory later on. It's quite surprising how accurately you can call them right there on the spot. And of course, your calls are valuable anyway, because you may be the only person who ever sees those bones if they're destroyed in transit. All right, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to move through the skeleton from top to bottom, talking about the various points which differentiate males from females, just as though you were excavating the skeleton, starting working by yourself and starting from the skull and working downward. And we'll start, actually, with the skull. Okay. Don't pay any attention to these small points. Those are points for measurements that are made in anthropometry. They don't have any application to what we're doing here tonight. Now, as females reach puberty and go beyond and reach actually maturity, their skulls retain a lot of the pre-puberty traits that males have a tendency to lose. That is, that males, on the whole, tend to be more robust, the muscle insertions tend to be larger, and the skull itself, as well as certain points on the skull, some tend to be considerably larger and can be measured with a fair degree of accuracy. And I'm going to mention it if I got here. The wrong page. There. Good. Now, these traits are not very easy to quantify. It's not very easy to walk up to them and say, well, we should call this one one plus, and then two plus, and then three. What we do normally is we measure presence or absence, and then degrees of presence if a trait is present, and that is normally done with a one plus or a double plus or a triple plus or even a quadruple plus. Now, although these are not metric, as I told you, they have an exceedingly high degree of accuracy, and in fact, I would say, as a result of T.D. Stewart's experiments in the Smithsonian on this, in which he tested himself and then tested all of his students as well, he had something like an 89% accurate sex call as a result of the non-metric traits taken from the skull, which was every bit as high as some of the work that was being done with measurements by some of the other anthropologists there. In the skull, the traits that are most indicative of sex are the orbits, the edges of the orbits of the eyes, right here, this edge, the superior orbit especially, the relative size of the brow ridge, the size of the nuchal crest, an area of muscle insertion here on the back of the skull, the size of the mastoids, the chin, and that is the superior aspect of the mandible, you're looking down on it, and the shape of the mandible, and I'll go through each of those individually. I have here, I've brought the bones of a female to match up with this male here so that you could see the differences clearly. The female, her bones are actually quite friable and delicate because she's an early Bronze Age female that we excavated from Umm Magal last year. She was in a perfectly intact tomb. In fact, when we got into this tomb, the only damage that had been done by the bulldozer. It nicked the side. Some of those of you who may have been out there will remember that the bulldozer nicked the side, cut a little hole, and that we were later lifted on the shovel of the bulldozer and we crawled inside, and she was lying there looking as though she'd been inserted a few months ago rather than in the EV4. Now, she's almost immature. She has almost another year of growth ahead of her here before she died. And so her stature is a little bit less than it might be for a full-grown female in her population, but nevertheless, it's close to being the same. Take this off. I'm always afraid of breaking it. I remember when I crawled in there. I mean, it occurred to me that she was lying there when Rome rose and fell. She was lying there all through the Crusade. She was lying there completely undisturbed while Lawrence was blowing up the Hejaz Railway, and then along came the wimpy bulldozer and knocked the whole thing down on top of her. Didn't seem fair somehow. All right. Now, this is a little bit difficult for you to see from this distance, but I'm going to try to point it out to you anyway. If you look at the superior side, oh, that's a good place to hold it right there. Right along the edges of the orbits on the superior side, that means the upper side, you'll see that the female is quite sharp and the male is rather dull. Now, that seems to you as though it's a very subjective thing, and you say, well, one man's sharp is another man's dull. That's true. It does take a fairly trained eye, but you can train yourself in a relatively short period of time through examining lots of skulls to see that. The mastoid process is this process right here, which is quite exaggerated in this drawing. They're seldom if ever that large. Now, that's actually a muscle attachment with a sternomastoid muscle. Now, you may know that in a quadrupedal animal, an animal who walks on four legs, the nuchal muscles in the back of the head here serve to hold the head up, a little bit like a cable on a steam shovel or something. Whereas in man, because we've become bipedal, we have one of our biggest problems in terms of holding our head up is that our spinal axis comes behind here, and the greater weight of the head is forward, which all of us have experienced on airplane flights. And we just go right out. Now, another problem we have, of course, is once you've tilted your head back, it requires more in the way of muscle exertion to pull it forward, because we don't really have any muscles that are in the front here that are designed for that. Most of the muscles that we have are designed for a quadrupedal animal. So we find that this sternomastoid muscle has moved forward somewhat. This mastoid has become enhanced in man, much larger than it is in other species. And what it does is it attaches to the sternum here and serves to pull the head forward. Not very efficiently, but nevertheless, since it is a muscle insertion, it tends to be larger in males than in females. You can look at hers here and compare them to his, and one of the reasons I like him is because he has small mastoids. You'll notice that his mastoids are not, his mastoids are not much larger than hers. Gives you some measure of just how difficult this can get. I wish I'd gotten a better one than that. That's a little embarrassing. They are small. Okay, the occipital crest in the back is a place where these nuchal muscles attach. In the female, as you can see here, it's relatively smooth. In the male, I'm afraid the teeth are going to fall out if I put her down too hard. In the male, it's quite pronounced. You see that crest there? Can everyone see it? Okay. That tends to be, now, everyone knows a few females who are larger than most of the males they know. And everyone knows a lot of males who are smaller than most of the females they know. These are not ironclad references of gender. What you do is you make observations on all of these facets, and then you compend what you have. And I might add that the skull is not the best indicator of sex. We'll get to the best indicator momentarily here. Now the chin, if I can find your chin, doesn't have it. Okay, the mandible of males tends to be bilateral. If you look at the mandible here, you will see two points, one on either side. It's not very pronounced here, up on top, and here also. You'll see something like two points. In the female, that tends to be rather triangular. When you look at them from the superior side, the best way to look at it is not from this side, but the way you're looking at it now. And females tend to be triangular, the males to have two points of bone, one here, and a rather squared off surface in the front. That again is a very subjective measure, but it's remarkable just how accurate it can be when you're calling these things and you test yourself against a collection of known sex. Okay, the malar bones are also something of an indication. These are the malars, they're the cheekbones right here. In males, they tend to be quite large, and in females, small. Now, if you're going to do it metrically, back in the laboratory, I'm sorry we don't have time to show you all the different measurements that you would use. There are 17 different measurements that are made on the cranium and on the mandible. And those measurements are fed into, well, what they have is a weight. Each of them is given a decimal weight, which is either higher or lower than a whole number, the whole number you normally being one. And that weight is all of them are added together into a score, at the end of which you have a sectioning point, and if it's below that point, it's probably female. If it's above that point, it's probably male. It's a rather long and involved process, and it does not, in my experience, testing myself against, again, collections in the United States and the Smithsonian of individuals of known sex, it does not have any, it's not superior, it's not better. I don't get a better score by going through all of those measurements than I do just by looking at these subjective non-metric traits and making what I would call a moderately educated guess. Okay. Now, in the literature, if you read any of the books on this, they talk about the clavicle, which is the shoulder bone here. It's right in here, to the left. A clavicle being indicative of sex. And in many of the earlier reports that you might read, if you're ever looking for information about bones, they're few and far between anyway, but when you do read them, you'll find this being used as an indicator of sex. It's not. It's not very useful at all. The overlap between the sexes in this bone is more than 80 to 85%, which is outrageously high when you think that some people have actually written reports in which they said this one was a male because the clavicle was such and such a maximum length, and this one was a female because it was such and such a maximum length. And unfortunately, after having been tested by people in objective fashion, it didn't work out to be useful at all. The scapula, which is, let me see if I can find a scapula here. I'm sure I have one. Everybody has two. At least I don't have one. Well, the scapula is the shoulder blade bone along the back here, the one that you can see when you punch your elbow backward this way, the one that sort of pokes out. On that surface, there is an articular cup called the glenoid cavity, and that glenoid cavity is rather tear-shaped, and the maximum length of that glenoid cavity from top to bottom is indicative of sex. It's not very good. It has an overlap in excess of about 30%, which is pretty high when you're trying to discern males from females and you have no other criteria to go on. Possibly it's something that you're going to have to use. You can use it as additive evidence. That is, you take the measurement, and then later on in the laboratory, you include it with what you've said, but you would never use it as the sole indicator of sex. Now, in the humerus, which I showed you earlier, see if we can, actually, I guess we don't have to go back to it since everybody knows what one looks like. I don't think it's possible to go backwards. The backward button works backward and forward, and so does the forward button. Well, in the humerus, it's often been thought that the maximum length and the epicondylar breadth, that is the breadth of the bottom of the bone down here at the elbow joint, are indicative of sex. But again, they are not. After having been tested again by T. Dale Stewart at the Smithsonian, it was found that the overlap was 76% to 78% in both of those measurements. And so it's not worth taking them. But again, it's going to confuse you if you're an archaeologist working in the field, if you take any of the relevant sources that you can find and try to study what you should be doing in order to find out, to discern males from females, you're going to discover that people have been using criteria in the past which are not very useful at all. However, the humerus does offer that one measurement I mentioned to you earlier, the vertical diameter of the head, which has an overlap of only 13%. And that, again, has been demonstrated only in modern populations, not in ancient populations. But I think for the moment, we can assume that it's useful. And as we add to our knowledge of ancient populations, it's becoming increasingly clear that it is. Every time that I make a sex call on a skeleton, what I normally try to do is make these measurements beforehand, if I can, if I have the time, guess at the sex from these measurements, and then look at the evidence from the pelvis and the skull, which is more indicative. And I've found that there's, in fact, a very high correlation there, and that these can be used with some success. Now, what I have on the board back here, for those of you who feel that you might be excavating in the future, is I have some measurements on the vertical diameter of the humerus for modern American populations. That, and what this means here is up to 43 millimeters is considered to be female. From 43 to 45 millimeters is considered to be female, question mark. 45 to 47 is considered to be male, question mark. And from 47 millimeters on up is considered definitely to be male. Now that, again, is for a modern American population. In Neolithic Portugal, in some skeletal samples I've examined, I've discovered that the average move down, the average skate down, you might say, for this sectioning point of 45 millimeters between the two sexes is 4 millimeters, which puts it, for an ancient population, well below the range of what we would definitely call female in a modern population. So whether that applies here or not, it remains to be seen. And if we start finding skeletons, and any of you folks are working on them, you will be making a definite contribution to our ability to tell males from females, since these pieces of the humerus are often left intact. They're too large for rodents to carry away. And by measuring that quite carefully, and then comparing the information we get from it to the pelvic information, we'll be making a real contribution to osteological research here. All right, what about overall robusticity? Is it possible to pick up a humerus, an upper arm bone, hold it up and say, that looks male? In fact, it is possible to do that. People do it all the time.
if it's large and looks rather powerful, you can do it. And it's surprising how often you're accurate. I tested myself, or at least I tried to test myself, really only on a sample of, I think, 60 skeletons. And I was somewhere in the range of 80 to 85% correct most of the time. But that, there's no guarantee of that. Remember, that was a modern American population we were looking at, and in pre-industrial populations, females tend to do much heavier labor. I might get hurt for this. I'm not saying that women don't work. All I'm saying is that they tended to do much more in the way of robust labor in pre-industrial populations, even if you just consider the amount of lifting and bending and moving that it took to cook in a colonial kitchen, let's say, a colonial period American kitchen, as opposed to a modern kitchen. I mean, there's plenty of female truck drivers around, I'm sure, but if you find their bones, you're liable to be fooled. That's all there is to it. Well, the next thing is the sacrum. I'm going to try to get this thing to go backwards, although actually I guess I can just do it from here, because this is a picture of the pelvis articulated. This is the sacrum in the back. We don't know how it got the name sacrum, incidentally. It seems to be related to the Latin for sacred or sacral, or having something to do with ritual activity. It's been suggested that because it has so much spongy bone in it, that they used to throw it into the fire to see which way it would crack during divination. You know, you try to find out what the future holds for you, so you throw this bone into the fire and then read it. I don't know if that's true or not, but nevertheless, it is the tailbone in man. This is what's left of our tail, not very much, the coccyx at the bottom. Now, the sacrum in males tends to be rather more curved, and in females to be rather straight. Now, that's a very subjective thing to say. You can't judge it in the field unless you've looked at lots of them and you have some idea. I can't tell you how many degrees the angle should be. It's, again, very subjective, and this is not what I would call the most useful of sex indicators, but we can't overlook it, because sometimes it's all you've got, and if it's all you have, then you most definitely have to employ it, although you always put several question marks after it to show people that you're basing it on a criteria that's not altogether reliable, or perhaps not reliable at all. Now, the reason for that, incidentally, is it would be quite clear, I think, if you think about childbirth, it becomes clear. This sacrum can actually, because of the curvature, can get into the way of childbirth. And so, in females, you would expect it to be flatter and have less curvature in order to leave the birth canal more open for free passage. Okay. The next thing I wanted to mention is the innominate. The innominate is the left or the right bone of the pelvis, which is really not one bone by itself. Each innominate is a composite of three bones, that is the ischium, the ilium, and the pubis, which fuse together during adolescence. Nevertheless, we treat them each as one bone in adult specimens because they've already fused, and of course, quite definitely, with a better than 92 to 95% chance of being correct. And on top of that, you can say something about parturation, if it's a female. By parturation, I mean approximately how many children she's had. Now, some people put more confidence in that than others. J. Lawrence Angel, who's done a lot of work to develop it, feels that he can practically count children by looking at these scars of parturation. I don't go along with that entirely, but nevertheless, it does tell you something about parturation. So when you're excavating, especially if the body is lying on its back, you're going to discover that this is pretty high up. It's easily damaged. It's so delicate, especially in ancient specimens, that just by touching it, it breaks off. I would ask if I thought that it could be done, but I know how difficult it is when you're working in the field to get this stuff done. I would ask that you photograph the internal edge of this right there in the field, because so often it's smashed in storage on the way back. And it is the most critically important part of the skeleton. I do not want to emphasize this too much, however, because I feel that all bones are important. Even little fragments of bones can be important. And it's surprising how often when you'll find that a small fragment, when you fit it together, is the piece to a puzzle, especially in pathology, where you were looking for a piece of the bone to see whether or not the bone had been attacked by pathogens in a certain region of the skeleton. And it turns out that the critical piece of bone is just the one piece of bone that happens to be missing. In fact, Dr. Helms, who smokes and smirks yonder, he discovered several skeletons in some tombs that he was doing a rescue operation on, and he retrieved all of the bone. They had been badly shattered and broken up.
And he brought them back almost apologizing because they were in such bad condition, but he wanted to see if anything could be gotten out of them. And in fact, all three of the first three individuals he brought back were pathological in one way or another, and one of them was pathological with a skull lesion that at first, although I thought it might be a primitive form of brain surgery, I'm leaning more toward the idea of some sort of rapid carcinomic disease, some sort of cancer. I'm going to send it off to the Paleopathology Association for someone who's more expert than I to have a look at it. But nevertheless, all three out of three of those skeletons that he brought back showed evidence of early disease. And we don't really know that much about early disease. We don't know where these diseases have come from. We're supposing in many cases that diseases are as old as man or as old as settled man, you might say. We don't always know that for sure. Okay. Now for determining sex, the way that you can, well, you have a handout there. If you look on your handout to that rather poorly made picture of the pubic bone, that is this area, I don't think you'll have too much difficulty recognizing it. Okay. The difference between males and females there is that the female pelvis is adapted for childbirth, and therefore you find more in the way of a broad bowl shape. And in order to obtain that broad bowl shape, the body of the pubic bone, among other places, is somewhat extended, is somewhat larger, relatively speaking. Now, this is an immature female, so she doesn't show us this very well. However, if you look at this angle and look at the much better, much clearer specimen that you have on your hand out there, you'll see that there is a what is called a subpubic angle here, which is not normally present, or at least it is not pronounced in males. Now, again, I have a male here who's a little bit disturbing. He does have a subpubic angle. This is the same one I used last year. I was really taken by surprise by this last year because you don't usually find it, you know, and when I knew that the skeleton was a male, and I picked it up and I started talking, and everybody was staring like this, and I looked down, and sure enough, a subpubic angle, an hermaphrodite. Well, not to be ruled out as a possibility, I guess. Let me see if I can get a clearer example here. May I borrow your handout? Perhaps that's the best thing to do. The one on the bottom is the female. The white arrow points to the subpubic angle. I would like to call your attention also to this secondary angle, this thinning out of the bone running along to the ischium here. That area is also indicative of being a female, although it's not normally referred to. There's a small raised crest, which you will see only as a white line in this reproduction. That crest is also found almost always only in females. Now, there are other parts of the pelvic anatomy where you can find indications of females, and this one is what you would call a rule of thumb because you quite literally put your thumb in there. This is called the sciatic notch because, among other things, the sciatic nerve travels underneath and through it. If you just put your thumb right in there, you'll see that you have a great deal of room to move your thumb back and forth. That, again, is a function of the broadening of the pelvis in preparation for childbirth. In males, you'll find that the lower edge of the ilium there is hooked downward. And you have, this guy is a real disturbing. He's in between. He's got it hooked over there. It's not completely out of the range of being male. But if I just found this bone by itself, I would think that that was quite possibly a robust female, a rather large female, and I would say that sex was undetermined, if only on the basis of that subpubic angle. Don't you love being wrong? Okay. Another thing that is absolutely certain to tell you that it's a female are scars of parturition. Scars of parturition are the scars that are left by childbirth, and I'm afraid I don't have any examples of that here. I'm going to use this male/female pelvis to show it to you simply because it's less delicate than this female here, and also the bone color is not distorted by dust. The scars of parturition will show up on the dorsal side, that is the back side of the pubic bone, the side that points inside. You also find them on the front, but for some reason, actually not for some reason, because of the size of the ligament there, they're almost always more pronounced here. During pregnancy, enzymes are secreted during about, I guess, the fourth or fifth month of pregnancy that help to loosen up all the cartilage surfaces, the articular surfaces in the body, not so you fall apart or anything, But in order to make it easier to go through the trauma of childbirth, listen to me talking about the trauma of childbirth. What do I know about the trauma of childbirth? Huh? I feel very safe, you know, standing up here. Nevertheless, these scars of parturition show up in a vertical way, right here, right on the inside, and in a place which is often called the preauricular sulcus, which is a line running right along the side of the sciatic notch, right here. You can look for these, and it's a roughening of the bone in a rather an elongated fashion, an elongated shape, and that's the result of the strain of the pelvis being stretched during childbirth. The number of males who would display those would be insignificant, I'd say. Okay. Another item, also to be found in the pelvis, is sacroiliac osteophytosis, which is just what all it means is little bone growths that grow apart, grow across, especially inferiorly here, from the iliac, from the ilium onto the sacral bone here, and actually fuse the pelvis together into one bone, or one bone composite. Little bridges of bone there. In almost 95%, I've forgotten the exact figures, of known cases of this condition have been males. We almost never find it in females. And the reason for that is actually quite easy to see. I mean, a female who is still in childbearing years, whose pelvic area fuses, does not have much chance of survival, especially in a pre-industrial population. I mean, she would probably die in the next childbirth. So we don't find it that often. Now, completely lost my place here. There are also metric means of doing this. This you will not be doing in the field because it's too time consuming and because often you won't have the proper instruments to do it with in the field. They're very expensive and hard to get. But I'll mention them anyway. The metric means are actually three pelvic indices that are supposedly indicative of sex. I'm only going to mention one because I think only one of them is worth mentioning. Only one of them really works. And it works just about 95 or 100% of the time. I don't think I've ever seen it fail myself. People have said that it did fail. That is, you take the length of the pubis, which is measured from the interior of the acetabulum, which is the socket. Perhaps it's better for me to show you here. The length of the pubis from here to here. And it's measured from the point where the three bones fuse. Now, it takes a certain amount of knowledge of skeletal anatomy to figure out where that point is, but you can learn it in a day or so. It's not all that difficult. You multiply that by 100, and then you divide it by the length of the ischium, which is measured from here to here, from the same point down to the bottom of the ischium. That gives you an index. That is, what you're doing is you're making one bone represent a percentage of the other bone, the length of the other bone. And up to about 84 is male. 84 to 88 is considered to be sex equals question mark, and from 88 upward is considered to be female. I'm going to move on to the femur, and I hope that I can get this thing to go backwards. Yes, there's the femur. What we're talking about in the femur is just the maximum diameter of the head. Now, it's obvious that you can look at these two bones, and you can tell that one is larger and more robust than the other. And you might say to yourself, when I'm excavating, if I saw a bone that big, I'd know it was a male. If I saw a bone that big, I'd know it was a female. And that's true. You probably would, and you'd probably be right, but still you can't depend upon it. And one of the best things that you can do is take, the maximum diameter of the head. Now, notice that in the humerus, we ask you to take the vertical diameter of the head. In the case of the femur, please note that you're supposed to take the maximum diameter, move your calipers around until you get the maximum measurement. I have those written down here on the board. For the femur, up to about 42, up to 42.5 millimeters is generally considered to be female. From 42.5 to 43.5 is considered to be female, question mark. And notice here a difference between what we have for the femur and the humerus. The humerus is a better indicator of sex than the femur. We have an area of sex which is completely question mark, from 43.5 to 46.5 millimeters. From 46.5 to 47.5 is male, question mark, and from 47.5 up is considered definitely to be male. Again, this is a modern population. And my guess is, based upon my experiences with the Neolithic bones in Portugal, that you have to move this down 4 millimeters for ancient populations. That hasn't been proven yet, and I hope that we'll be able to prove it sometime before I leave Jordan, if we have enough bones to work with. Incidentally, the overlap between males and females, in the case of this measurement, is about 17%, as opposed to only about 9%. So it's still quite good. I'm going to move on to the determination of age. Actually, I should say the estimate of age. You determine sex and then put a question mark after it if you're not sure, but you actually estimate age. There are two real processes that you observe when you're trying to estimate how old, biologically, how old an individual is. Note that I'm talking about biological age of the person, not the archaeological age or how long it's been in the ground. And those two processes are, in fact, they overlap each other. It's growth, the growth of certain systems of the body, and then almost as soon as you're finished growing, you start degenerating, and it's degeneration. In fact, the two overlap. For those of us who are fortunate, they don't overlap very much, but still they do. What I'm going to do is start at the youngest and work our way to the oldest, working our way through the human life, suggesting which parts of the skeleton give us some information about age. The first I'll talk about are a fetus or a newborn child. Now, it's not unusual, altogether unusual, to discover the skeleton of a female with a fetus. That, in fact, it should be more usual than it is, but the bones of the fetus are so small and so delicate that they're very often overlooked. And if we were sifting all of the bones, I'm sure that we would come up with a much clearer idea of just what the rate was of death for females from childbirth. Now, we have some indication of this. We have some indication of it just by looking at the age at death curves that you get from taking age estimates for whole populations in the ancient world. And almost always, I find, in pre-industrial populations, the curve is that males have a short a small die-off period in their early 20s. Now, what that is attributable to, I don't know. It could be disease. It could be that males in their early 20s are unusually aggressive. They get into fights. I don't know what it is. But after that, they're pretty safe up until the time they're in their mid-40s, and then they start dying off. Females, however, have two curves, two death curves. And the first one starts at age 15 and goes through about age 23, especially the ages 17 to 21, which are prime childbearing ages. And I would interpret that, although I have no proof, because the excavations on the whole have not been careful enough to see if a fetus is involved or if an infant, a newborn infant, is involved. Well, of course, the infant might survive and the mother die. But nevertheless, I'm sure that that's attributable. I'm sure, listen to me. I think that that's attributable to childbirth. Thereafter, incidentally, although this isn't directly related to what we're talking about now, the female die-off thereafter is in the mid-30s. In other words, the females tended to live shorter lives. Whether that's based upon, but whether that's the result of differences in access to food, I don't know. Although, as I mentioned, I think once before, it's difficult to eat better than the cook. You know, I'm not sure that it would be differences in access to food. But I would say that the rigors of childbirth, especially repeatedly throughout the lives of these women, I'm sure shortened their overall life expectancy considerably before antibiotics and whatnot. Although now, as we know, in modern populations, females tend to live 7 to 10 years longer than males. And in fact, I knew a fellow once who wanted to write a paper about how wealth was transferring itself gradually into the hands of females in modern American society because they were always outliving their husbands. I don't know whether that's true or not. It's an interesting idea. Well, so in a fetus and for newborn children, the only real indication you have of their age is their long bone length. And as I told you, in immature specimens, you have these epiphyses, which are unfused elements of bone, especially in the long bones at both ends, which only fuse at about the time that the person reaches maturity. Now, in a very small child, these are almost always lost in excavation because they're almost impossible to tell from a small pebble. Although after a while, you do get an eye for a bony texture and you do pick them up. And of course, they're useful when you do. As everyone knows who's had children, or knows anybody who's had children, the size of children when they're born is quite variable. that you have children, the difference could be as much as a few pounds between one child and another. And of course, that difference is also reflected in their long bone length. So this is not a what you would call an ironclad indicator of sex, or age rather. It's only a very approximate one. But it does tell you to within, I would say, 2 or 3 months, whether the child was newborn or a fetus. And of course, an early fetus is not going to be discovered at all. A fetus in the 7th to 9th month, if you're excavating carefully, and you'll probably be able to find that. And that will be easy to tell because the long bones will be so short and undeveloped, you'll be dealing only with germs of bones in many cases, and it's not too difficult to tell what they are. Now, you also, in very young children, once the child has reached the age of 1.5 to 3, in that range, you have what are called the unification of primary bone centers. The primary bone centers, it simply means that certain symphyses, like by a symphysis we mean a place where two bones come together, like on the chin here, it's called the mandibular symphysis. Those bones fuse together to make one solid bone, the mandible, whereas during prenatal life, those bones are not fused. There are other areas that do the same thing. The vertebrae, the center of the vertebrae, fuse with the neural arches of the vertebrae, which later form a protection for the elements of the central nervous system going down through the vertebral column. The rate at which those fuse is quite variable, but nevertheless, it almost always happens to all of these primary centers before the 2nd year of life. So that can be used as additional evidence. Now, for young children between the age of about 2 and 3, actually, you can get a... Do I have a copy of that yet? I guess not. May I have one of those? Thank you. If you turn your page over tonight, you'll see a handsome scrawl on the back here. And on the very top, you'll see deciduous tooth eruption. The tooth eruption is one of the clearest indications of age in small children. Now, the letters on the left-hand side stand for incisor, molar, canine, and molar. M1 stands for the first molar. M2 stands for the second molar. Now, the children have two incisors, but the lateral incisor, I2, does not come in on a reliable schedule. In fact, sometimes it comes in before the first one. So we exclude it from this chart. What you have there is a rough measure of when these come in. The first incisor is supposedly between 8 months and 13 months. I have been told that in modern populations, it's more variable, that sometimes it's younger and sometimes it's older, and I don't know why that is. However, in populations living in, I think, Afghanistan in the 1930s, where this was measured on the better part of 1,000 different children over a period of about 12 years, that's when this chart was compiled and was actually coming in on a fairly regular schedule. Now, whether that has some cultural cause or not, I don't know. But nevertheless, there you have it. I would expect that would be a more reliable indicator in an early population than it is in a modern population, although I have no explanation for that. The first molar is the next tooth to come in between age 1 and 2, the canine between age 2 and 3, and the second molar is usually erupted by the 3rd year plus, meaning that by about the middle of the 3rd year, that second molar is usually erupted. I'll bet that everybody who has a child can give me at least one example of how this thing doesn't work. This is not cast in bronze by any manner, or by any means. I would take all of these together and average out the results, and then make a guess. All of these things are only means to making an approximation. None of them are ironclad guarantees that you're going to get the child's age down to the year. Although, again, sometimes you surprise yourself. The permanent teeth, which is the next chart down here, is useful for children from about age 6 to about age 12. These come in on a much more reliable schedule than the deciduous teeth do. And if you look at the mean ages there, I think that chart is self-explanatory. M1 stands for the first molar, which comes in at approximately age, incidentally, read that 6 years, 4 months, not 6.4 years, but 6 years, 4 months. Notice that I say maxilla and mandible, and I separate them because they come in on different schedules. The maxilla is the upper jaw, the mandible is the lower jaw. And again, this is another example of how males and females mature at different rates. We have a different rate for males than for females, and the females, on the whole, are ahead of the males. So you have to determine the sex of the skeleton before you do anything else. Before, I have one bit of discouraging news, however, along those lines, and that is that pre-puberty skeletons are almost impossible to sex accurately. You can do it. There are techniques for doing it, especially by examining the developing pelvis, but it would be very difficult to do in the field. And the measuring instruments you would need to make the measurements would be so expensive you would want to take them into the field, even if you had them. So I wouldn't worry too much. The best thing to do in the field, if you see that the mandible is in a delicate condition, is to make note of what the stage of eruption is for each of these teeth, and just to scribble that on a separate piece of paper. In fact, you almost always need a separate piece of paper besides the burial form that you have for extra observations. And make a note of that, just in case the teeth fall out, as they so often do, before it gets back to the lab and they filter through the bottom of the bag and are lost forever. Thank you. Okay. We might jump ahead just a little bit and mention the third molar, M3, which is sometimes called the wisdom tooth. Now, this is a genetically unstable tooth. It seems to be on its way to being a vestigial trait, you might say, like our appendix, for example, something that is, in an evolutionary sense, on the way out. Some of us get it, some of us don't. Some of us get it, but we have trouble with it. Some of us get it on the top part of our maxilla, and we don't get it in the mandible, which is the case with me. I just noticed that about 3 years ago. You'd think you'd know yourself better than that. Nevertheless, that is a fairly reliable indication of age in late adolescence to early adulthood. Now, it usually comes in a modern population, the mean age is supposed to be between 18 and 21. I would say that you should expand that and say between 17 and 22, at least. I know several people myself who didn't get them until they were in their late 20s, and there are people who don't get them until they're in their 30s and early 40s occasionally, but that is the exception to the rule. And if you were to encounter something like that skeletally in a dried bone specimen, there would be other indications of age you could use to cancel out the misinformation that you were getting from the teeth. I'm shouting again, sorry. Okay. Now for children and adolescents, we have another indication of age, which is called the union of epiphyses. Now the union of epiphyses refers to these things I mentioned to you before, these elements of bone at either end. They fuse. They fuse at a fairly predictable rate on a schedule, which is different for each bone, and different for that matter from each end of each bone. If you were to try to clump these together into areas of union, you should do it by joint. Certain joints fuse before other joints do. And there are charts for this. You don't have to do this in the field either. The only reason why I mention it to you is that as you are excavating each bone, you should look for that. You should look for those epiphyses and see whether they're joined or not. If they're not joined, you're going to get something that looks exactly like this. That's exactly it. Now, this is at birth. Again, as I mentioned the other night, these are not to scale. This is what they look like. The ones from the top are especially easy to see. Some of these smaller ones down here on the medial epicondyle, for example, are very easily lost or overlooked. This chart from Bass is not all that accurate, incidentally. Nevertheless, you should notice whether or not they are fused, whether they are just about to fuse, whether they are in the process of fusing, or whether they have just finished fusing. And one of the ways you can tell if it's just finished fusing is by looking for a small seam, which you may or may not be able to see here. I'll hold it up to the light. It's a small line which runs around, which takes about a year and a half to 2 years to disappear. Perhaps if I hold it up in the light can anyone see that small line around here? No? You're kind of far away. You're welcome to examine it after the class if you like. That shows that her epiphysis probably joined within 18 months before her death. In the case of an adult, of course, you don't find any significant trace of that line at all. If you do find any lines, they're generally the result of arthritic lipping, as in the case of this one. Not very great, but still tough. I'll give you an example of an epiphysis which is not on a long bone, but which fuses on a surprisingly regular rate and demonstrates this girl almost conclusively to have been 17 years old when she died. And that is this one, which runs up over the top of the ilium.
It's a long band of bone that fuses, and it's probably the most reliable of any of them. I don't know why he doesn't mention it in his text, but it demonstrates almost conclusively that she was 17, and that is supported, incidentally, by the evidence of her teeth. If you look here to where the maxilla is broken out somewhat, you'll see the crown of her third molar beginning to break through, suggesting, again, that she was between probably age 17 and 22. And then that, together with this evidence, you add them together, and you have a pretty clear idea of how old she is. We're coming up to probably the most accurate means of telling age, which we will also get from her pelvis in a moment, and that is the pubic symphysis. Before we get to the pubic symphysis, however, I'd like to mention one other item, which is the thoracic vertebrae. You have 12 thoracic vertebrae. They're the central vertebrae in your vertebral column. They are the vertebrae which support ribs. Now, those vertebrae have rings of bone, you might say, which are essentially the same thing as an epiphysis, and they fuse at a fairly regular rate between the age of 17 and 26, and they fuse in order. Generally, not always, but generally. Now, again, I would never base a forensic age call on that. I mean, if you're being called into court, as physical anthropologists often are, in order to establish that a murder has been committed and this is the body of a 17-year-old girl, you wouldn't want someone's fate hanging in the balance while you thought back to this epiphyseal ring and said, "Yeah, she was 17, all right. String them up." It would probably. You might not sleep too well after that. So it's not all that reliable, but nevertheless, it is additive evidence. Now, the metamorphosis of the pubic symphysis, that is the change of the pubic symphysis, is the first change we've come to, which is not a developmental change, but rather a degenerative change, the beginning of breakdown in the body. This is the pubic symphysis. By symphysis, again, we mean the place where two bones are coming together, a non-moving joint, you might say, or if it does move significantly, you're in a lot of trouble. Now, that breaks down at a rapid rate, in fact, during early adulthood, slows down, and then begins to break down again in I would say, middle age to the beginning of old age. It is useful for determining age between the ages of about 19 to 21 and the age of about 50 to 55. And although it is not so accurate at either end of those scales, in between, in precisely the areas where we no longer have teeth to work with, it's very accurate. Accurate, in fact, so that some people claim that you can get the age to within 2 years using only the pubic symphysis. It takes a lot of practice to get used to looking at the pubic symphysis. Oh, these are more examples of epiphyses on other bones. Here's the pubic symphysis, and I believe you have a chart among your handouts. It would take a long time to try to explain just how to do this. There are actually three systems for examining or utilizing the pubic symphysis. The most accurate of them is that of Thum, Scheel, and T.D. Stewart, who spent a great deal of time going through what is called the Terry Collection in the Smithsonian, which is a collection of specimens from dissecting rooms and morgues in the United States. Incidentally, if you talk about skewing factors, I mean, for many years, people were for a few years, students were using the information from the Terry Collection in order to establish what the average stature was for people in the United States. But it took a graduate student, in fact, to suggest to someone that people who wind up in morgues and dissecting rooms are not usually indicative of they're not going to be Harvard graduate students for the most part, and they're not going to be well fed or well nourished either. I mean, if you live on a diet of Sterno, it's very unlikely that your bones are going to reflect an average for that population. So that's been corrected for at the insistence of graduate students. Have you ever noticed how often graduate students actually come up with these answers? Now, it was a graduate student in South Africa who took the bones of two supposedly entirely separate hominids from the Pleistocene period, one of which was being called Talanthropus, and which were discovered, I think, as much as 7 years apart, and were considered to be representatives of different species, and put them together and discovered not only were they the same species, they were parts of the same individual, parts of the same person. Pretty weird. Okay. The things to look for in this are what are called ramparts building up along the edges.
Now, this doesn't happen in the very early years. You see the age is 18, 19, 21, 24. But as you go on toward the later 20s, you have a very slow building up of a smooth area here on the dorsal side. This is the dorsal side that is toward the back. What you see this way is the ventral side. This side is the ventral side, meaning toward the stomach or toward the front. Now, that builds up first in the ventral side. It's not real clear here because these are drawings of drawings. It's much clearer in this item here, this specimen, and this one. You also want to check the center for the progressive disappearance of what we call ridges and furrows here. These ridges and furrows are indicative of a very young person, and they gradually disappear through the early 20s. They are replaced by a granulated surface with a few small nodules of bone, and in females, especially if they're having a lot of children, you find scar tissue here. But the scar tissue need not throw you off. It's fairly easy to recognize, especially if you're looking on both sides of the bone for other elements of scar tissue which suggest that it's